Welcome back to the Chats with Creatives podcast. I'm Bronte Charlotte, an actor currently living in Nam, Melbourne. Just before we begin, I want to acknowledge that every episode I record on the stolen lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. If there are any First Nations peoples listening today, thank you so much for being here. This is Radical Acts of Resistance with Lucy Ansell. Lucy is a powerhouse of a woman. She received a Green Room Award for Best Performer in She Is Vigilante. She is currently ensemble in Harry Potter and the Cursed Child, and she is an absolute hero of mine when it comes to standing up for yourself and being clear on your values. Lucy is one of those incredible, incredible women who is so strong and settled and grounded and has just this calm and gentle aura about her. She makes everyone around her feel so supported and loved and valued. And I really, 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 really respect that about her. I look up to her in so many ways and I am so, so proud of the work that she has done, particularly since leaving VCA, but also in VCA. If any of you saw any of the work from the time that we were in VCA together, oh my God, she is a wonder human. The way that she expresses and describes her experience as a woman of color, the way that she articulates prejudice and racism and colorism and tokenism and all of those things is so, so intelligent and so fascinating and so open and honest. These conversations that I have with Lucy about race and casting and theater are some of my favorite conversations that I have with another creative human being. She is beautiful, heart and soul and love and generosity, and I am so excited for you to hear this discussion that we have today. Lucy Goosey.
My dear.
How are you?
I'm well. I'm here. God, I was smiling the whole way here, but no one could tell because I had a mask on. Just a creep on the tram.
I've been enjoying, and this is a weird thing to say, my hay fever this year has been like so much better because I've been wearing a mask outside.
Oh my God, talk to me. Not even, you don't even have like that stream down just down the eyes.
I've had like super itchy eyes every so often. And then I had a few too many red wines one night and I got like hives all over my face.
Oh.
Yeah, oh. I know. It was like quite the
album. I was about
to
be like, it do be like that, but not always.
Not always.
It doesn't have to be.
Yeah, so I had some a hive reaction when I was like, no. So then I started taking like antihistamines, which I wasn't doing prior to that because I was going okay due to the mask. The antihistamines helped. The hives went away. It took about 8 or 9 days to go down and I was like, what have I done to myself? Gosh. And haven't had wine since. Quick way of making me stop.
Well, welcome back to non-hive land.
It's good. It's good to be here. How's your morning been?
Good. I feel like strangely still and centered. I think it's because my shower head's broken and I've been like having to have lots of baths.
Oh,
like, oh, poor
how
me.
Pleasant.
I know, yeah, it's been really nice, really nice.
Oh my God,
I would
love it.
Recommend if you've got any sort of tub.
I don't.
Okay.
I have.
Get a little kiddie pool?
I don't think. Oh my God. You said kiddie pool. I literally thought you meant kitty pool for my cats. And I was like, I don't think they'd like that. They don't love the water. And then I was like, no, Bronte, that's not what that is. That's definitely,
I mean, you do
for
you.
Kids, not yeah. kittens. I've considered it. Do you know what I did do this morning though? I don't know if people are going to think I'm crazy, but I'll tell you because you deserve this.
Thank God no one's listening to this.
Really. Lee and I woke up and we were like, oh my God, the sun's out. Oh my God, we have nothing on today. Let's go to the beach. And it's like, I don't know what the temperature is, but it's so cold. And I was like in a bikini and a summer dress.
But you went?
Yeah.
Oh my gosh, yes.
Yeah. We went down to Elwood and we got out and it was so cold. Literally everyone on the beach. There's like one other person just like sitting on the sand in like a puffer jacket and like big boots. And everyone walking along the beach was in like puffer jackets and like jeans. And I was there in like a dress, like, oh my God, the beach.
No, oh,
we both just forgot we were in Melbourne. And so
right?
We,
yeah. I went for a dip in a lake yesterday.
Really?
Yep. Didn't have a towel. Still, oh. I'm actually still damp.
It doesn't come out. Where's this lake?
It's called Plenty Gorge. Have you heard of it?
I have heard of it, yeah. But only in the last week.
Oh, true.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah. It, true. There's plenty of it. Plenty really? Of it.
Just desk hand sanitizer coming out. Okay.
It's getting real.
How did we meet?
Tinder. That's a joke. That's not funny. I had the absolute pleasure.
Oh, an honor.
Pleasure colliding worlds with you at uni. What an absolute time.
What a journey.
It's a pivotal time. Honestly, it's like my birth, rode a bike, school, meeting Bronte. That's.
I feel that.
That's.
I feel it.
Death, really. That's
death is next. Good times. Yeah, so we did. We did go to the VCA together. It's becoming a bit of a trend, isn't it? People I chat to are all like VCA grads. They're like, we met at school. Listeners are getting bored. They're like, fucking hell. Give us a little rundown of who you are and your history in the creative industries. Who I am? You know, just like your birth story.
You know what this is reminding me of? You know how like we have to write our own bios? Yes. But we pretend, we do it in third yes. person. We pretend it's not us. a history of who, what was it? Who I am and my birth? And
yeah, like who you are, like I want your identifying like internal features, like yeah. whether that be a liver or like you eat cashews. I'm kidding.
I've got a few organs.
Great. How did Lucy come to find acting?
For me, I was always that annoying kid. Oh, I feel like it's quite normal for little kids to make up little plays.
And oh, absolutely.
Like, you know, instead of buying your parents an actual present, you just sort of do a little weird dance for them on God, like Mother's yes. Day and stuff.
But like you're so proud of it as well. And you're yeah. like, this is your gift. Yeah. It's me doing a dance.
You are welcome. I just feel like I never stopped doing that. And it was like it just wasn't cute anymore. Like I just never really stopped, to be honest. But I still, like, it took me a really long time to, like, legitimize that.
Mm.
It was always just, like, a hobby or, like, something I knew I really enjoyed doing, but I was always, like, I just sort of bought into the narrative that it wasn't, like, a quote-unquote real job or if it wasn't something, like, feasible. And so I'm still sort of working away at that to try and, like, validate that just within myself. But only really the last sort of few years, I reckon since uni or... I don't even know. I think I was still sort of working away at it during uni, but kind of since uni having to sort of reprogram what that means to me. And so it does still feel very new. I still feel like a little sponge baby swimming around.
It's so interesting to hear you say like it's a very like new thing because looking at what you've done, like the space that you have of your career that's going to extend like for many, many years, the space you've created is amazing. I had like a moment of like, oh my fucking God, Lucy. And I read your bio. But like, honestly, I know the work that you've done since leaving VCA, but this is mildly ridiculous. So your first year out of drama school, you booked a highly renowned agent. You've booked guest roles in different series on network television and ABC TV and all sorts of things. You received a fucking Green Room Award for the best performer in individual theatre for your role in Vigilante at Theatre Works, which was gorgeous. And you also had a few weeks on stage doing Harry Potter and the Cursed Child. You were swinging fucking Cursed Child, which is amazing. And so you had a few weeks performing in the Cursed Child before Melbourne went into lockdown due to the global pandemic. What is that like? I've just like read out your first year out of drama school to you. Does that like feel weird? Like, does it feel like a natural progression to have leapt onto all of these like amazing things? Or does it feel like, was it unexpected or challenging? Or did it just feel like a smooth ride? Tell me about it.
Oh my gosh. I feel, oh God, closed caption. I'm almost sobbing. You know, it's like, it's so bizarre. I never, ever, ever, ever expected to be able to do what I have been so lucky to be able to do. I forgot about some of those things you spoke about. It's just been such a like whirlwind of a year, but I think it's super, super heartening that there are so many. I feel like obviously everything's sort of, I mean, suspended and everything's on hold at the moment, but there's just so many beautiful, incredible pieces of work being made right now. And I feel like the last few years has been sort of a momentum building, and people we're sort of really starting to reshift our focus on what stories are being told and who's telling them, and trying to sort of we're just sort of working out how to do that sensitively now. I think there's so much focus on representation, but it does need to be more than that. Representation is not enough. We need reform. We need restructure. And I think sort of just before all of this huge like global halt happened, I think it was really cool to see sort of the changes starting to happen. And I feel ridiculously lucky to have had a little part in that.
The things that you've already been a part of, is there something that kind of stands out as like that surely has happened for a reason, or it led you onto something else? Or is there something like that stands out for you?
Oh, I mean, I would genuinely just say all of it, to be honest. So many of the sort of opportunities I landed myself in, like, I feel like just the day before I almost quit, to be honest. Mm. You know, it's just, that's so the works of the industry. So I pinch myself for absolutely everything you listed just then. I think for like a little 8-year-old me, like being part of, you know, the world of Harry Potter is still like probably the most ridiculous thing I will ever be a part of, honestly. And just like learning the machine of like such a massive like commercial production, it's seeing kind of the ins and outs of it is just like the biggest of privileges, honestly. I have such a newfound appreciation for the craft and for like that specific side of the craft, I suppose.
It's cool that I was thinking about this the other day, like how Cursed Child, obviously a huge piece like that, and we both have people that we know in it. You now you know everyone in the cast. I feel like it almost must function as a musical. It's different to, you know, an indie theatre piece going on at like 45 Downstairs or even Malthouse. Like it's a scale that is so large. Yeah, I can't imagine the inner workings that you're talking about, that it must have been so, so crazy to like witness them, especially on something magical like Harry Potter, when you have like a connection to it from childhood.
For sure. Yeah, totally. I think the bizarre thing for me is like doing 3 years of training and then kind of throwing it out the window. And I know that that's not true, because it's definitely like informing absolutely everything I do with it, but it just sort of occupies or requires like just a different part of the brain. And it's I have so much admiration for people who can sort of extend themselves and show up every single day for such an extended longer period of time and just give it their absolute all and put it all on the line night after night after night. Like that kind of rigor is so incredibly admirable. It is. I've heard this a little bit in terms of like comparing it to a musical, and I think there's definitely some like overlaps in sort of the structure of it, for sure. I think it's so like technically sound and so like specific and challenging in the way that a musical is, but at the same time you can see glimpses of like the I suppose like a Malthouse formula. Like it's like a kind of conglomerate of like types of performance, I suppose, which is really cool. And like I think it's definitely like a really awesome experience and like teaching lesson for an actor to sort of work in that. It's like the whole I'm genuinely just learning the whole time. I'm just like, I think I, you know, I could do it for a year and still be learning like new things after shows.
There is a zine. It's like a magazine. Is it a zine or a zine?
It comes back to the GIF or JIF debate.
What do you say? I say GIF.
I know it's JIF, but I so want it to be GIF.
Is it official? Is it JIF?
I just don't know anything.
This is such a bad word. JIF. I'm going to say zine because it's a magazine.
Yeah,
why isn't it a magazine? Okay, so there's this beautiful zine from by Where Are You From? Did it start as an Instagram page or did it start as a zine?
It's a bit of both. It's been curated by art worker or Sabina McKenna, and it's essentially, I think it started as a Instagram, but it was also, it was curated in galleries basically. So
yeah, right.
They had like an online platform, and I think there's a website as well linked up to it, but the zine is also one of its children.
Yeah, right. Okay, so I have before me Hair, which is a zine. My understanding was that it was the second publication, like hold in your hand book. I could be wrong. It's such a beautiful, beautiful creation. I fucking love it. Even the photos by Shannon May Powell are like stunning. Everyone is so stunning. It's just different people who have these incredible relationships to textured hair, and it's so beautiful. And I'm going to read a section of Lucy's, which is on the first page. Do you know what, Lucy? I mean, I'll let the listeners listen in a moment. It is so poetic, and you've articulated so beautifully your experience with, you know, that you've had your relationship with your hair. And oh my God, it's honestly, okay, so this is right towards the end of Lucy's excerpt. In high school, internalized thinking and general apathy towards my troublesome, in inverted commas, coils led me to take a vow of hair abstinence. For 5 years, I locked it away in a despondent bun. The more men reached out to stroke it, the more I tried to keep it from their grasp. I lessened and minimized myself until I didn't take up any space at all. I weathered myself down so much, my identity was collaterally sanitized. For black and brown femmes, our market viably rests on how well we hide and contort our hair. With those of us whose texture closely neighbors the fringes of whiteness, working notably less hard than the rest. Texturism lurks in the shadow of its unfavorable colleague, colorism. The loose pattern of my curl makes my brown more palatable. I've been told I have the good kind of black hair, a compliment that works harder to insult us all. Truth be told, my hair has never felt exclusively mine, rather a public site I've been hired to maintain. It is perpetually policed, controlled, surveilled, fetishized, co-opted, violated, and exoticized without my consent. Leaving it in its most natural, unadulterated form still feels a radical act of resistance, a carousel that orbits blessing and burden. For now, I'm still ambivalent. I no longer collapse all my worth with my hair, but there is still so much unlearning to do. Oh my God, Lucy.
It's so nice to hear you say.
Okay, that's literally only three paragraphs of what you've written, and there's so much in there. There's so much in there about like how racism and colorism is connected to like someone's hair. It's so infuriating and so like upsetting to me that people have this experience, because I mean, I'm blonde. I am the appearance of that kind of like straight blonde hair that so many people in this publication have talked about wanting or feeling like that's the only acceptable way to have hair. And I've never had the experience of being in your shoes or a person with textured hair's shoes where you want that straight silky look. It blows my mind that it's so linked to, you know, I mean, like anything in our appearance can be so linked to our self-worth, but it's so layered and complicated when someone has textured hair, because it's also linked in with colorism and racism and identity and history. Reading these things was so eye-opening and so intimate. It felt really intimate that I had spent 3 years with you at VCA and I didn't know that this was the relationship that you had with your hair. I mean, it's not something that you talk about on the daily. It's just something that you experience internally so often. And it's almost like because you're living in this society that comments on or tries to touch a part of your body, it's silenced. Like your experience of it is silenced. And I just wanted to acknowledge that and be like, I don't understand this experience because I don't have textured hair, but these writings and your writing in particular, because I know you, they were just very eye-opening and very upsetting to read, to kind of hear from so many different people their experiences and how closely linked they all were. And it was something I literally had never thought of. I didn't know it was a thing that existed. I only found out recently the natural hair movement. Mm-hmm. I honestly didn't know it existed, and I feel really naive. And that's my problem. But like, I just thank you so much for writing this and for being so honest. Now I've talked.
No, totally. It's super, super, super heartening for me to also flick through and to see myself in all of those stories, because I definitely didn't see it growing up. And I think I would minimize it because I kind of did feel like I was kind of an outlier in that, because I didn't see that other people were feeling that way. I didn't know that it was, you know, a systemic issue rather than my issue. Mm-hmm. And I remember, you know, it's kind of written from the lens of like a four-year-old me who had already like successfully downloaded my own implicit bias. And I remember it started with a conversation with my mom. I remember having when I was three. And I asked her why I had to have brown skin, as if it was some kind of hindrance. I asked her why I had to have this hair, why I couldn't have the other hair. It was the other hair. Mm. And it's amazing to me now, because we look at three-year-olds and we think that, you know, the only thing in their mind is snacks and playgrounds. But we are not ever immune from structural racism, and it starts from a very, very, it starts after we exit the womb, and it is ongoing, it is relentless, and it's cyclical. And I think I didn't really speak about it growing up. It's interesting you say I didn't speak about it at VCA, and I think it's because a part of me was still, I was still ashamed, for sure, still ashamed, because hair feels so... I feel like hair is linked to vanity, but it is also a signifier for so many complex issues. And for instance, I think my hair is the first thing that outs me as a person of color rather than my actual skin color. And I know this because I've experienced someone yelling something at me from 30 meters away, from only seeing the back of my head. And I think I've learned to kind of weaponize that. I do know that if I tie my hair up in a certain way, if I sort of slick it back, especially if I'm feeling slightly more vulnerable, if I wake up feeling a bit more vulnerable and I'm just like, not today, like not any day, but especially not today, I've kind of learned how to navigate that world, because I often, you know, often my experiences start with walking in the room and it's might be just like a casual comment on my hair.
Like I did when you entered.
Well, you know. You
Lucy's
know,
had a fresh cut and it's gorgeous.
But it's like, you know, that it's very different. The context is so different coming from such like a dear friend as opposed to walking into a room and being reduced down solely to my phenotype.
Yeah. Does it ever translate into things that happen within the creative industries?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Like the creative industries are just mirrors. If anything, I think they're actually a bit behind. I think it's a really tough thing, because at the moment I feel like I'm straddling, or not straddling, kind of vacillating between tokenism and erasure.
Yeah.
So it's like I can say no to the few projects that come up if they're tokenistic.
Yep.
But the alternative is not getting work. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what we're really starting to put money behind, works that are neither of them, that yeah. are sensitive, that are, you know, written from a lens and through a canon that hasn't gotten a lot of airtime. And it's a very odd thing to kind of, I feel like sometimes still, just because it's like, it's just the way of where we're at, it's like I still will accept some works that I feel slightly compromised on, just because we're still not yet at a place where all of the work is being done sensitively and honoring the voices that deserve to be honored and amplified.
Is there an example of work that you feel like is a great example of amplifying those voices?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think last year was a very exciting year, especially for main stages. It's invigorating to see it happening on our stages. And I think Golden Shield for me last year at MTC was a big one. It was it covered so many complexities and densities, and there was so much like nuance and things that I'm still understanding today, even like a year on. I'm still like still sort of chipping away at little bits of it because it was just so, so well done. And I want more. I want more. And that it's happening. It's happening slowly, not quickly enough, obviously. Like there's still been, even just recently with like the Robert Guest Endowment, there's clearly so much progress that is still yet to be made. You know, it comes back to that quote of, when you're so accustomed to privilege, equality feels like oppression. And I feel like there are still some gatekeepers in this industry who are, you know, trying their hardest to keep the door closed to sort of just for their best in their own interest, really. Yeah. What about you? Like, is there any works recently that you've been excited about or you feel is kind of the way forward?
Yes. Yeah. I keep thinking about Wake and Fright at Malthouse. That was a one-woman show, Zara Newman, which from my understanding was a book. Yeah, originally a book, and it was kind of like this Australian story, but she'd like taken it and messed with it, and it was just her on stage playing all these different parts and doing a fucking incredible job. And I was like, yeah, so that's right. Like, why shouldn't people of color or women be on our main stages doing a one woman show about, you know, whatever the fuck they want, but also like representing an Australian story or like whatever it may be. There's many, but that one's like coming to mind.
Absolutely. It's such a like, gosh, it shouldn't be as political as it is, but
I know.
A woman of color to take up space on a stage for and hold an audience captive for an hour and 40
my God, she holds you captive minutes as well. Yeah. Like, she's such an incredible actor.
Like how, that is such a seldom, like we don't see that.
Because I think in a way we don't allow it.
Absolutely.
I think the industry, like, yeah, it still is not at a place yet where they're allowing that sort of thing to happen. And it's taken Zara like however many years since she started in the industry, 10 plus years, for her to get to that point of being like, no, this is, I'm going to fucking do this one woman show and I don't need anyone else to be on stage to kind of like lessen the impact I have. This is all we need. Yeah. And I just find that, especially as a woman, to watch that and just be like, fuck yes, thank you so much. But also then just to add to that another minority of being a woman of color. And it just, I loved seeing that. And I also think in the same year, I went to Sydney and saw her in an STC production, and she was the lead and she fucking stole the show.
Oh, she would have. That's the thing, right? It's like, it's no longer just a question of letting people into the room.
Mm.
It's what is the room? You know, it's like, to me, there's no point in like diversifying spaces if you're not interested in actually diversifying the space. Like, it's people and institutions specifically are so interested in looking culturally diverse, but zero interest in actually being it. Yeah. And that means attending to the health and well-being of the people you're letting into the space. It's like, if a flower is wilting or dying, you don't blame the flower. Like, you look at the environment, you're like, okay, well, what's wrong? Like, what's happening with the soil? What's happening with the sun? And I think it's a really dangerous thing to bring people into unsafe spaces. And you would not plant a flower if you knew that that soil was poisonous. And so I think that's something I think we really need to start to add into our praxis.
That's a really powerful metaphor. Yeah, it's interesting you say that Zara Newman just being on stage and taking up space is a political act. Mm. It's mentioned in nearly every piece in Hair that wearing textured hair naturally is a political act, even though it's literally just wearing your hair naturally. how dare you? Oh my God, it's so wonderful that all of these people are coming to this point where they're like, fuck this, I'm going to wear my hair naturally. But the fact that that is political is just, it's just such a such a clear representation of how systemic racism and colorism is. Like, it's fucked that is a political act, because it's the bare minimum. Shouldn't be.
It's literally like just existing as yourself. Yeah. Minimum. You don't owe anyone.
It's horrifying.
Anything like my hair existing in its sphere is not like colonizing other people's real estate. Like, this is just my hair.
Yeah.
And yet it's so much more.
Have you ever had a role or even a job where you've been told to kind of change it, to slick it back or straighten it or anything? A situation where someone has kind of implied or said that you have to?
Not necessarily in this industry. I feel like it's kind of a, going back to talking about how I said I feel like I can weaponize it now, because unfortunately, because it is kind of exoticized, often without my consent, it is sort of, I feel I can benefit from other people's glamorization of it. Mm-hmm. It's context dependent again, mm-hmm. but it's definitely came up in school quite a bit. I remember almost getting detentions because it was unruly, or, you know, I remember having braids and that was an issue. It was like unprofessional. God. Like, it was like damaging the image, you know, and I was like, well, what image? Like, and I remember being so stressed as like a 10-year-old when my mom used to braid my hair in like the most beautiful braids. And of course I would like get to school and wait for her car to drive away and then just like rip it into a side fringe. And sometimes that meant my hair would like unravel and I didn't know how to plait my own hair. Mm. And so I'd be like stuck in the school playground, like, they're gonna know that I have hair. And not like knowing what to do. And I remember like just thinking I was gonna be in trouble because of that. Because it is like time and time again, like either through words or through actions, we are told it is less professional. We're told that it is doing yourself a disservice to wear it naturally. And to me, that is just so bizarre, because, you know, I straightened my hair for like 4 or 5 years and that damaged my hair. It was such a dichotomy of that, like the contradiction. I remembered feeling so confused because I was like, okay, but that is better, but it's worse for my hair.
Mm. Which again is something that is a part of your body. And obviously you don't want to be damaging your body or like doing something for you that's not healthy or whatever it may be. Like, yeah, it's very conflicting. And correct me if I'm wrong, but you went to a predominantly white school.
Yeah. I mean, I've grown up in just predominantly white spaces in general.
Yeah.
And I, you know, very, very privileged spaces for sure. But it did sort of act as like a faux bubble, I suppose. Mm. And at the end of the day, it can't protect me from everything. But I had to learn that.
It would be so hard to grow up in a space where your hair is othered and to also not have people that look like you or people that have textured hair on our screens, on our stages, or like around you if you're in a predominantly white space or suburb or school or whatever it is, to not kind of have someone around you that you could like look up to or see style it in a certain way, or, you know, just wear their natural hair proudly or whatever it may be. Because, you know, me growing up as a white woman in Australia, I had that. I had fucking the whitewashed American TV or TV shows or movies coming our way. And my school, I think we've spoken about this before, my school was predominantly white. At a high school of about 600 students, there was no one that was not white at my school when I was there. No one. And in my primary school, there was one Indigenous family. That's it. So my experience of different cultures and people coming from different places and different hair textures, I didn't experience that until I moved to Melbourne when I was 18. And yeah, fucked. Fucked, Lucy. And I'm furious about that. And that's me in a space where I'm the norm, essentially. I can't imagine what it's like for you to grow up in spaces where there's an issue with your hair. That's ridiculous. And also so unfair. Even just by reading the zine Hair, it's essentially a normal experience for people with textured hair, which is really upsetting.
I'm just nodding, by the way, furiously, just furiously nodding.
I don't know. It's a weird thing to think about. Again, I think we've talked about it before that, well, number one, I feel like the education in the Australian education system is just like horrifyingly uneducating. It's like, it's not honest or true to any extent. I think in primary school, I had maybe 3 or 4 weeks on Indigenous history, and the rest of the year was, you know, old mate Christopher Dude. I don't even know his name.
Either you're talking about Christopher Columbus.
Yeah. Yeah. The rest of my school year was like. See, my They're fucking education is
awful.
My education is like so fucking lax, and I'm furious about it. And get me onto a fucking topic of sexual education, and I'm just as fiery about it. Our education is so lax, and it's just, it infuriates me. And I'm also very confused because it's not my place to kind of be angry about. I don't know. I don't know if it's my place to be angry about how you were treated in your childhood or your upbringing in regards to your hair or your race or whatever it may be. Like I get confused about if that's appropriate for me as a white woman to be this passionate about it.
I think it's, we need your anger. We need your anger as well because we need your anger to open up spaces for us. We need your anger to hold spaces for us. We need it to excavate and bulldoze doors and walls down. And, you know, it's like stories are being democratized. But you're right. It comes back to, like, I think we have a real cultural amnesia in this country, and it's where there's so much talk around stories, and yet we're still ignoring our history. We have such a whitewashed, ridiculous, like insipid view of our history. And so how could we possibly reconcile for that when there's just, when we're up against ignorance?
That's it. It's just ignorance. Like, I think something that makes me so furious is the ignorance of like, if people as children are not being educated, that then grows into young adulthood, and then the next generation comes along and it's like they're not being educated. Our history, the true honest history of Australia and colonization in this country, is being disintegrated. It's being hidden. I feel like it's being hidden. Absolutely. Especially in our education. It's being hidden from us as children. And so then from my experience, I get to 18 and I move to a city like Melbourne, which is beautifully multicultural. It's my first experience of understanding that so many more people share this land than what I had thought in my tiny little whitewashed high school in Brisbane.
Yeah.
So this, I think you're right. Our history has been whitewashed completely.
And it's no wonder that it is still so devalued if we grow up that way.
Yeah.
That's why I think teachers have such an important job, because they shape us as individuals. Like we learn what we learn from those ages, and no degree of protectionism is at all helpful.
Can you imagine if in your schooling, if your hair was celebrated by your teachers and your peers, like how that would change you and your relationship with your hair?
Totally. And kids are so impressionable. Like,
oh, I remember, absolutely.
Like hanging on to every single like tick I got from like a little sticker teacher.
Yes.
And it's like we teach value early. We teach and we learn value
so early.
And worth.
Yeah. Which then translates into self-worth, which then also translates into how we treat others, how we treat ourselves.
Absolutely.
And if we, you know, respect ourselves or others enough to self-educate, if we haven't been educated properly, if we're kind of taught from a really young age that it's not needed or it's not necessary, or you don't really need to learn about that. It's like, well, when does that view, that value change, and how does it change?
It's a real active thing. We need to activate our aesthetics. Like it takes actual, physical, tangible work.
Absolutely.
And we're all at different points with it, and it's ongoing. That's the thing. It never ends. The work has not finished because we retweeted a hashtag.
That's so true.
Like it's yes and. What's next?
I remember we had a conversation mildly recently on our socially distanced walk about the Black Lives Matter movement and how that kind of it took a toll on people of color at that time, because it was kind of like, oh, wow, and thank you. You're only realizing now that we need a bit of awareness or a representation or acknowledgement, and that took quite a toll on people of color around the world, being like, how is this only happening now? And also, it's your job as a privileged white person to fucking educate yourself on these issues.
But I think one step further is it is not up to Black and Indigenous folks to dismantle the systems that oppress them.
Absolutely not. How can they? They aren't the system.
Absolutely.
You know?
Yeah.
How could they possibly dismantle it when they are literally, they're not allowed in the door of the system?
No, and like this has been said 100 times, you know, nothing that's being said is new. It's just, they're just finding new ways of saying it. But, you know, people keep saying that, like, we need to fix this broken system, but the system is not broken. It is working exactly how it was designed to work. It is, like, thriving. Mm. The system was built on the backs of BIPOC, and it is no wonder why it is so hard to dismantle it, because it's
been made really well,
just incredibly well made, and we're still fighting and working against the vestiges of colonization. It is ongoing, regardless of how much people try to downplay that. Yeah, I think it's been a really heavy year, especially for Black people, and I think, as you say, for myself, like I've always sort of like fed into model minority complexes, and I've always felt like I need to be sort of like at the front line all the time. And I think I kind of learnt, especially in light of the George Floyd killing and the revolt after that and the anti-Blackness renaissance, which sort of the aftermath of that, I actually kind of had to unplug a little bit. I was, you know, I turned up when I could, but for the most part, I think, and having spoken to, you know, a few Black friends and friends of color who were, you know, experiencing and feeling very, very similar things of sort of feeling a bit despondent or tired. Mm. Because it was a time of mourning for sure, and I think I think for a lot of us, we just kind of had to focus on regulating, I think, and just turn up when we could turn up.
Which is, I think, probably really hard to do and really hard to set those boundaries when I'm sure that there were so many people who weren't familiar with these experiences, maybe like coming to you for answers or just in general like asking the Black community what they could do.
Sure.
Which is, again, I'm sure it comes from a place of like, what can I do? How can I help you through this time? Or what can I do to change what's happening right now? But yeah, I can see how that would be just too much and poorly timed with everything that was going on.
Definitely.
At that particular time. Yeah. And also a little bit upsetting and disheartening that it had happened then, that it hadn't happened like before, that people weren't coming to you before being like, hey, what can I do today, or like whatever it may
Absolutely.
Be or,
yeah. I think for sure that was something I grappled with, was mourning the absence of friends up until then in terms of showing up for things that sort of revolved around or oscillated around race. And yeah, I think it's definitely I think I have a little, especially as like a lighter skinned Black person of color, like mixed race, I feel a certain responsibility though to sort of play middleman or middle person in that environment, because I feel that I do definitely benefit off my lighter skinned privilege, and I have more, because of my proximity to whiteness, I'm definitely more watered down and more palatable version. And so I feel like for me, I did actually really want to take on, I wanted to take on more work so that darker skinned people didn't have to, because I also benefit in such a discreet but very obvious, it's like such a contradiction, but it is, it's colorism is so rife, it's so real. And so I definitely spent a lot of time trying to work out how to navigate that, I suppose. And I'm still working it out, because I know that everyone needs to start somewhere with their anti-racism practice and praxis. I'm personally okay. I feel okay with the sort of emotional labor demand a lot of the time. I'm very open to sort of chatting, especially to close friends, about things, because I think it is important for growth and for learning, but I don't think it should ever be expected.
Do you know what? Something I have always remembered you saying to me
I've just been thinking about it a lot. You once said to me that you were just as white as me.
Yeah. And
what
I think
does that mean?
I was going to ask you. I was going to ask if it was.
I wonder if that's something that was like maybe a protective agent or like a self-preservation thing to kind of. Racism is so rife in our society that it's like you have to do whatever you can to kind of protect yourself and stay safe.
Yeah.
And so I wonder if that comment kind of comes from a place of trying to save yourself from racist comments or differing opinions, dehumanizing comments, like whatever it may be. And I also wonder if it comes from a place of saying that to someone who isn't as accepting as they should be. Like, or at the time maybe I wasn't as open or I don't know, like I honestly don't know. I can't remember what the context was, but I just it's really stuck with me. Wow. As you can see.
Really? I mean, like, I don't actually remember saying that either, but I'm it doesn't surprise me that I did. I think if I can try and tap into the mindset of what that would mean to me now is that having, as we said, grown up in predominantly white spaces and PWIs, predominantly white institutions, as I think people call them, I actually really do believe that the only thing that really does separate us is phenotype. Because I would have eaten the same things as you growing up. You know, I would have had my Wednesday lasagnas or whatever. You know, we went to similar kinds of schools, went to the same uni, and have more or less similar experiences traversing the world up until now, more or less. I am a person of color, but I'm very, very, very disconnected from the place that has melanated me. Apart from, you know, having like an incredible black mother who gales me of like beautiful stories of Trinidad and Tobago, which is where her family are from, I've never been. I was never told about it at school. I would love to reconnect with that culture, but at the same time, my circumstance was that it was so far removed growing up. And it's like, whilst I felt like displaced from that, it's not necessarily inaccessible and it's not too late. But I think that's what I would have meant by I'm just as white as you, because I have had a Western education. I am so, so, so privileged to have received a tertiary education in a city with like clean sanitation and a roof over my head in Melbourne or Nam.
I do sometimes worry that it came out of me asking you a question or saying something a little bit stupid and you being like, nah, dude, like, no, I'm just as white as you. Sure. I don't know.
Maybe. I think I get a lot of people like who have different levels of like ideas of what blackness is or what, you know, and this is not you. This is just like people in general. A lot of people will say to me, oh, I dance like a white person or something. And I'm like, I am just as lanky as you. Like,
yeah. That, like what you just said there, you changed that white to lanky.
Because that's what I assume.
Right.
It's the assumption
of words. The word is wrongly placed, I think. That comment of like, you know, I dance like a white person or I rap like a white person or whatever it is. I think that's wrongly placed and again, an example of our systemic racism.
Totally. And it rests on the assumption of, it rests on assumption that we know it's like just complete generalization, which has been like just blown out of proportion. But the same is said, as you said, for black people, because it's like I was expected to kind of perform blackness growing up, and I did. I didn't even really know what that meant, but I was like, okay, I've seen like, you know, I don't know the rap. You know, like I had friends who, you know, would time and time again be like, say it again, say hell no again.
Oh my God.
Like, we have such a myopic view of what blackness is, and it's reduced down to like the most bizarre things. And as you say, like we all kind of know what those generalizations are. Like, I know the connotation when people say I dance like a white person. I know what is woven in between those words.
I wonder if these kind of assumptions and generalizations, I mean, I don't wonder, like I know that they are in the industry, that, you know, characters can be sweeping generalizations of a race or a mental health issue or whatever it may be. How can you kind of separate the sweeping generalization from a really true representation of race?
First of all, it's not so much about bringing bodies of color into spaces. It's like, well, who's behind the lens? Mm-hmm. Who's behind the camera? Who is off stage? Mm-hmm. And what I'm personally seeing quite a lot is there's not really being much, there's not a lot of change happening behind the camera off stage. The stories are still being puppeteered by whiteness. Mm. And so how could it possibly be an accurate and sensitive representation? We can see it reads as not truthful, and very often that's because there's a lag and a disconnect between the producers and the production. We need to really look at the actual how of how these stories are being told. And it needs to be reflected in our audiences as well. And, it's all well and good, like, having, like, incredible productions like Golden Shield. But if the audience, if it's still an inaccessible production to the audiences it is targeted for, then we need to look at the bigger picture. We need to look at the larger structure of things. I think for a lot of actors of color in this industry, we are constantly, like, shifting. Big cognitive dissonance in trying to work out what is truthful and what is not, because there's a lot of things which might present as that, but they're actually quite disingenuous. Mm-hmm. And I think it starts with the producers and the writers. It starts with the environment.
Bronte got tired, so we have snacks.
We have acquired nuts.
Many are nuts.
Still thinking about scoop and weigh section. But it's just not a thing during COVID.
I know it's not.
Thank God it's not. But I was just thinking, when will it return?
I wonder if they'll keep the scoop and weigh section as pre-bagged. I mean, it kind of like really kind of ruins the point of it. Like, just package it anyway.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, just
for sure.
It's not even a scoop and weigh anymore.
It's like how much agency do you have? Like, how involved are you in the process? Like, I scooped all of these almonds myself. That's how I feel when I do it. And yet I just know that it's had like five people's hands in it. It's like, you know how people talking about like resuming normality after COVID, and everyone's like, why would you want to return to a capitalist thing? And I'm just thinking about, when will we return to scoop and weigh section?
I keep thinking about the fact that, like, when people walk past me, I'm always just like, mate, you are too close to me. Can you fucking take a step back? Like, don't rub your shoulder against me. Yeah. And I can't see that changing. Yeah, like, I'm now like settled into this thing where someone like runs past me and they're grunting. I'm like, mate, can you like not grunt on me? Or like,
like, I sneezed under my mask. No one was around me, but that felt like a crime. I was I deserve nothing.
as two young youths with hay fever, what else can you possibly
what
do?
What else can you possibly do?
If you need to sneeze, you need to sneeze. Mayhem.
That's so real.
Okay.
Okay, Google.
Quick fire questions.
Ooh.
No. What? Do you have something in your day that you just have to do, and if you don't do it, you don't feel right?
Oh, nap. Need nap.
Yeah. Oh, my God. Yeah. Okay, I wasn't going to go here, but please, the amount of times that I've been like, we've been like chatting or something. It's like 5 o'clock in the afternoon and we're like having a little message, and then I don't get any response until like 9 p.m. And Lucy's just like, oh, sorry, just dozed off. Like a 5 till 9 nap. And then you're just like up for the rest of your evening, having dinner and like whatever.
And then just low iron things.
Oh my God. Would you actually say that you have a daily nap?
I do, yeah. Regardless of how much I've slept.
Well, will you do a nap like straight after breakfast ever?
I have.
Yeah.
Especially like now I've got nothing to do. Like, yes. I will literally get up to eat and go back to sleep.
Yeah, I wonder if it's like, if you're getting up to eat breakfast and then you're going back to sleep, is it a nap or is it continued evening sleep?
That's true. And when does a nap become a sleep?
Because I would be close to saying that you're like 5 p.m. naps that go into the evening are sleep.
I don't trust like the 15-minute nap thing. I don't understand. I need at least 4 cycles of REM. I don't remember me by it.
This is my final sleep on your grave. Just like my final sleep. No more wake interrupting this.
That is so good.
I want that. Do you have a daily practice?
No, because I just feel so different on different days. I need different things on different days. I've definitely got things I rely on or little quick go-to shortcuts. Depends on what my body's feeling. Yeah, Yeah, it's more, honestly, like it takes very little for me to self-soothe. I will do the bare minimum and be like, I deserve to lie down.
That's kind of great.
Like I'm walking home from the shops, I'm like, I deserve this hot chocolate. Like I deserve it.
Meanwhile, there's me like just like at the door of the cafe, like, I've already had three today.
I would have passed you. I'd already been there.
I've had three hot chocolates. Can I have another? Lucy's like, I deserve this.
I'm just out there like bathing in Nesquik. Bathing.
Do you feel like you have a good relationship with yourself as an actor? Like as a human, but also?
No, I hear you. I feel I'm kinder to myself as a human and more forgiving of myself as a human and less so as an actor.
Oh,
is that even true?
I don't know. Expand.
Actually, I'm going to backtrack on that a little bit and say, I'd say that sometimes it's the opposite as well. Sometimes I'm more forgiving of myself as an actor and less forgiving of myself as a human. And I think that it's like, it's definitely like this kind of weird, like reciprocal inhibition in terms of like, oh, they're not mutually exclusive. I think I'm getting better at trying to separate myself as an actor and as a person. It's really hard when they are the same person. Through like using like acting as like a conduit or a vehicle, I feel like it's an opportunity to look at things from a different perspective and then be more forgiving of yourself in real life. So convoluted, but basically like I think it's something I will always be working at. I don't think I'll ever achieve or reach like a destination with that.
What's your favorite thing to do creatively?
This one is ever-changing because I go through phases of obsession and then I kind of lose interest and then I'll come back to it. At the moment, what I'm finding most joy is like tiny little crafts. I'm ticking off all of the isolation bingo things. Like I'm on the clays, I'm on the paints, I'm having a draw, having a little write. I'm sort of okay just like consuming almost trash right now because I don't want to like be on and like thinking all the time. And I think to just kind of sit in yourself right now and just be still and content with that. And that's the thing. So like realizing now how much of our life is just distraction, how much we've overcomplicated absolutely everything.
Yeah.
We just live from like distraction to like even work is a distraction.
Essentially, yeah. But it's also like what is the distraction and what is a defining part of who you are?
Ooh, retweet.
Yes. You can borrow it, but don't take it. Yeah. Like, I mean, for me, I'm really questioning like, going to theater every week or a few times a week,
yeah.
That I don't know if that was a distraction or if that was literally something that defined me. Like, I don't think it's a bad thing if it's a distraction, but then if it was a defining thing and now that it's not there, like I'm struggling to like define who I am,
sure,
without having these things or possibly these distractions around me to distract me from who I am. It's like I've been in this kind of like loop of like, am I?
Well, I mean, like this is getting so like existential, but the only thing that like we have to do is like survive. To be honest, everything else we fabricated, you know, like all we have to do is exist.
What brings you joy creatively?
Something that scares the shit out of me. Oh my gosh. Not always. It doesn't like, that's not to say that like I'm enjoying every minute of it. But I like things that terrify me. I really do. It's like, it's probably unhealthy. I've always enjoyed like uglier, messier characters, messier projects, you know, that's safely. But I think I'm creatively excited and invigorated by projects and people who are like unafraid to just put it all out there. And whatever that is, like that'll shift, right? But I am so attracted to such like fierce passion, I suppose. And it's contagious, right? It's like at the moment I'm definitely most excited by up and coming works made by and for Black, Indigenous people of color. And I'm excited to hear and see more stories from more points of view.
Is there a project that you're really proud of being part of or proud of the work that you did?
I think this is such a diplomatic answer, but I've taken so much away from so many projects, and I learn so many different things from so many incredible creative human beings. Definitely working with Shanella McCree, who wrote our piece for She Is Vigilante. The piece was called You May Not Rest Now, There Are Monsters Nearby. And it was written by Shanella McCree and directed by Bridget Belodis and Christilla Pierce. It was kind of one of the first times I felt properly seen. And I mean that on and off stage. It was such a learning process for all of us. We had some people of color in that space, but it was definitely like a collaboration with people who hadn't lived that experience as well. And it was definitely a huge like learning point for myself, working out where I belonged in that space and how much agency and responsibility I had within it.
Thanks, Lucy.
Thank you. Oh, my Lord.
Thanks for being here and being so open and honest with me and sharing your stories.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. I'm forever in awe of and inspired by you.
So that was my chat with Lucy. I hope you enjoyed it just as much as I did. Chatting with Lucy is such a treat. Anything that we discussed, I'll pop in the show notes for you to have a look at if you're interested. Otherwise, check us a line and we can chat about it together. All of the music for Chats with Creatives was created by Rick Scully, who is a musical genius, and everything else is me, hello, Bronte, your host. It's a fun time and I fucking love it. Let me know if you do too. Our next episode, I am so excited to share with you, is with the gorgeous Emily Goddard, which will actually be an exciting little Christmas special episode. It will be released on Christmas Day. So if you have a big lunch and then have nothing to do for the afternoon, I would highly recommend listening to this episode. It's beautiful and heartwarming and emotional and love-filled and just such a generous discussion. Emily shares so much and so openly, and it is really, really, really beautiful. Until then, stay creative.